Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to episode 95 with my guest Maria Bamford. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour. An hour of honesty? Not an hour, more like 90 minutes. 90 minutes of honesty about all the battles in your... I'm not going back. I'm fucking plowing ahead. 90 minutes of honesty about all the battles in your heads, from medically diagnosed conditions to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. It's not a doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room that... Let's see, what is our listener, James... says, more like a waiting room that hopefully doesn't have a really cute girl or guy sitting across from you who you really want to ask out, but you feel it would be so inappropriate you're literally paralyzed with shame and it derails your entire session with your shrink. Oh, that one made me laugh. So yeah, it's more like that. Not a doctor's office. I want to apologize for last week's... I was listening to, I couldn't remember if I had read a survey or not, and so I was like, oh, fuck, I'm going to go back to last week's episode and listen to the intro and outro and see if I read that one yet. And holy fuck, was I depressed. I hope I didn't drag you guys down with me last week, but I'm sure as you can tell from the sound of my voice, I am feeling markedly better this week. And... I had therapy today, and I don't know if that helped or what, but my therapist said that the progression in therapy sometimes is that you will have an incline and then you'll have a plateau, and that plateau may feel like you're back to square one, but you're really not. You are actually still further ahead than you were when you originally started. And then I shot her. Oh, that is not funny. That is why, of all the jokes I could have made... Wow. And I'm not going back. I'm not erasing that. I am standing by my poorly timed comment. And those of you that don't care for it, you know what you can do. I don't even have to say it now. You already know to go fuck yourselves. And speaking of going and fucking yourselves, I got an email from somebody from the forum whose handle is GF Yourself, and he had a great suggestion, which is to occasionally read posts from the forum, which I think I've done before, but it's been a while since I did it. And there's a thread that somebody started entitled "Can You Cry?" And a bunch of people have posted about this, about the ease or difficulty they have in crying. And somebody posted some statistics on crying, and here's the fucking weird part, is it's according to the German Society of Ophthalmology. Really, two groups I don't care to hear from. But apparently because the eyeballs make the tears, maybe they know something about it. But Although I shouldn't say that about Germans. I love Anna, our listener Anna, who wrote such a beautifully profound piece about what being an atheist means to her. But I am getting sidetracked. According to this study, over 300 adults, on average, men cry once every month. Women cry at least 5 times per month, especially before and during the menstrual cycle, when crying can increase up to 5 times the normal rate, often without obvious reasons, such as depression or sadness. According to this German Society of Ophthalmology, is everybody else, by the way, picturing them saluting Hitler like I am right now? According to the German, but seeing Hitler very clearly in focus. That was the nice, that's where that the Society of Ophthalmology really, when they were at the back of the, what's the name of the Reichstadt, they could see clearly into the front row. Wow, was that a belabored bit? Not going back. According to the German Society of Ophthalmology, which has collated different scientific studies on crying, women cry on an average between 30 and 64 times a year, and men cry on an average between 6 and 17 times per year. Men tend to cry for between 2 and 4 minutes, and women cry for about 6 minutes. Crying turns into sobbing for women in 65% of the cases, compared to just 6% for men. And they don't say how often the sobbing turns into masturbating. You guys master sob, right? Oh, you haven't lived until you've master sobbed. That is a sweet piece of business. And it doesn't say how many people... I'm... I had to stop myself. Because I truly knew at that point I was the only person on the planet that wanted to hear more of that bit. Let's go from talking about sobbing and masturbating to I want to read an email I got from a counselor. His name's Dave, and he's in Georgia. And he's talking about a couple episodes back when I read an email from a listener who was frustrated because I kept saying if you Google low-fee counseling or Google low-fee therapy in the name of your city, you should be able to find some place that works on a sliding scale. And this woman had written in and saying, I'm pretty much stop fucking saying that because I live in the boonies and I can't find any place and fuck you. So Dave, the counselor from Georgia, is writing in and he says, during your intro, you read a pretty dark email from a listener who can't find help in her area. This is so frustrating. I would like to encourage her to keep looking. In addition to Googling for low-cost counseling services, she can search for community mental health or community service board offices in her town or county. CMHCs, as they are often called, are a fantastic resource. They work primarily with uninsured clients and may provide counseling, psychiatric, and pharmaceutical services. The CMHC that I work at in Georgia provides services to a huge number of clients. Since Georgia is hardly the state at the forefront of providing mental health services, I tend to believe that people in other parts of the country may have an easier time accessing services than our clients do. She mentioned getting help at her local emergency department. In case of crisis or suicide, this is obviously the place to go. However, the doctors and nurses who work in an emergency department often are not interested or trained in working in psych. They may not know the local resources for help, or they may just not want to get their mentally, or they just may want to get their mentally ill patients out of the way. They definitely don't provide good ongoing care or medication management. If they don't provide good resources, she will have to seek them out on her own. But she needs to seek them out, obviously, or things just get worse and worse. And Dave, I want to thank you so much for that very, very helpful email that that you sent in. Well, I hope you guys are having a good start to your new year. I'm so excited to have Maria Bamford on the show. And let's kick it off with a quote from Mohandas Gandhi. Mohandas? Is that? I've heard of Mahatma. Mohandas. Is that like the Zeppo of the Gandhi family? Or maybe is that the main Gandhi guy? Wow. Brilliant. This intro has literally been a hosting crime scene. I'm gonna cordon it off and allow the podcasting detectives to come in and try to assess what went wrong. And the quote from Mohandas Gandhi, happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you are doing. God, I even fucked that up. Happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony.
Every human being has weird thoughts going through their head.
Oh God, it's so embarrassing.
I'm afraid I'll never get another job again.
That I will die and will have not been special.
My brain has the gift of seeing the terrible.
A million-pound tourniquet being turned against my chest that was constant.
Then I started sabotaging my own career.
Wanting to die and...
to stop him from feeling any joy.
That is...
very uncomfortable in my own body.
I ended up becoming a male prostitute.
And what I became was an animal.
They took away my shoelaces.
I became chaos.
Like, it hurts. I just want to go. I just want to leave.
You have no idea what a small part of your life this is.
If you go to a support group, it's like creating a family that you didn't have.
I mean, life is 1% event.
My body was abused.
99% judgment about that event.
But they couldn't touch the best parts of me.
But the world is a little bit wounding. It's also glorious.
It does always get better. It really does.
I'm here with Maria Bamford, and I'm so happy to have you on the podcast. I've been wanting to get you on for a while, and I know your schedule is pretty crazy, so I really appreciate you taking time out to...
Thank you very much. Welcome, Martin. Thank you so much. I desperately have something to promote, so I have to, and so it's sad that... Yeah.
Are you starting at the bottom then and working your way up to things that will actually promote it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Where do you start when you start promoting? It's
attraction rather than promotion, isn't it? Wait a minute.
I don't know where I got that, but it's a special coming out on Wednesday 28th. You can download it at chill.com, and it's an hour-long comedy special for just my parents in the audience.
You're just performing for two people, your parents.
Two parents. Well, cut out the middleman. Why get all these 800 strangers together, and that's being generous, into a theater when the only people I'm really trying to please... Marilyn Joel Bamford.
And Maria is not kidding. This is a downloadable special.
Yeah, no, it costs something. It's $4.99.
And you are literally performing just for your parents. I can't wait to see this.
Yes, especially when I close with the suicide chunk, but I serve pizza right before start going into the suicide material.
Oh my God, that's fantastic. I can't wait to see this. So I'm sure it will already be up by the time this airs.
By the time, yes.
Yeah,
because
I record these sometimes weeks in advance.
I'm so sorry for promoting something right in the beginning.
No, not at all. We'll promote it again at the end, and I'll make sure to put a link up on my website.
Yeah, so that's so much more appropriate.
Marie's already beating herself up. This is fantastic. So you are, for those of you that have been living under a rock and don't know who Maria is, she is one of the most original voices in stand-up comedy today. She has been very open on stage about her mental illness and makes light of it in a way that is so funny and so touching. It's like a lot of comics will skim the surface talking about their life and their pain, and they'll occasionally dip down a little bit into it. But like Maria, in the first 10 minutes of her act, will just go right to the center of the earth and spend your time there, and there's a bond that your audience members feel for you that is... Can you feel that depth?
Well, I'm having a lot of feelings during the show, but I usually don't go into my darkest material until... Or not dark, but more intimate material until, you know, I have to warm up and do some stuff about food, some light material about... gas station recipes, and how I wish they would provide them for... Have you ever had a gas station tuna fish sandwich? Oh, my God, it's so good, because there's no tuna in it. It's just a scrumptious, fishy nougat. Anyways, but so I start with something, and then I'll... Yeah, so no, I'm not. That was a very generous description of me, kindly. What I'm trying to say is I like talking about stuff like that, and I think now because of the internet, where you can get a specific, more specific audience, I think I get an audience that is more open to that, which is such a relief. So delightful.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of stand-up comedy in the 90s, it was very often the headliner and the audience, the audience just showed up for the comedian.
Yeah.
And for an original voice like yours, I would imagine that had to have led to some painful nights, because there are people that don't get you, people that haven't experienced profound pain in the place that your comedy comes from.
I think everybody's experienced some profound, but, or they don't want, because I understand, like, I like to go see music. No, I don't. Wait a minute. I've seen music. That's what I want to say. I've seen music, but I think, you know, I kind of like pop music, and I'm not so much like a folk music kind of likes, you know, sad, real songs of, and I think I may be the music, the comedy equivalent of something that I don't like in music, you know, not don't like, but just like, if I wanted to go out, oh, I want to go see Lady Gaga, you know, something super fun, and and some people, but I prefer to, you know, so I understand that people would, you know, I'm going out on a Friday night, I don't want to hear about the 8,000 U.S. veterans that die of suicide every year. Which is funny, because you think they die over there, but they come home. Oh, I thought it must be funny, because no one's taking it that seriously.
Have you said that on stage?
Oh, yes, yes.
And just awkward silence?
Yes, that's sort of a shock value. My dad was in the military, and I get so mad about it. I just get so mad. I've read... I mean, I don't know anything more than anybody else. I've just read magazine articles and listened to the New York Times and quoted as if it were the Bible. It is not the Bible, nor is the Bible the New York Times. And if there is a science, and we don't know, we don't know if there's a science, but there is a God. But what did I say? What was I? I can't remember now.
About more soldiers dying from suicide are dying overseas.
Yeah, why? What's going on? And my own personal experience with, you know, suicide or unbearable mental problems, you know, whatever those are for anybody, whether it is PTSD, you know, it is unbearable, and the reason that people kill themselves is not out of, you know, like sassy pettiness or like that, you know, like that just kill it. Well,
I'm not getting my way.
Yeah, right? Because the one thing I always hear is like, you know, or one joke I've been making, you know, people get so mad at you if you do that, they will get so mad at you if you commit suicide, which is like, why would you get, you don't, I mean, you can get mad at anybody for dying of an illness, but it's like, no, the reason they die is they suffering, just like, unbelievable suffering, but so much for society, I mean, even myself, like, when I got to a point where, you know, I was making plans to kill myself, I thought, it might be just a little bit less dramatic if I killed myself instead of going into a hospital, you know, like I would, you know.
Really?
Well, like, you know what I'm saying? Because
how long ago was this?
It was about a year and a half ago. I went into the hospital about 3 times. I had some sort of fiscal cliff. It wasn't fiscal. It was just a cliff. And everything was fine.
It wasn't triggered by money?
No. No. But no, it was.
Oh, just, you're talking about what's going on with the country.
The fiscal cliff. Which sounds fun sometimes when you think about it.
how tall is it? Is the water warm? So
yeah, I went. I you know, living in California where it's super liberal, super kind of groovy, and I'm a comedian, I'm in entertainment, and I have a problem with, you know, going into a hospital for 72 hours just so I won't kill myself. You know, I can't imagine, like, what these 18-year-old dudes who are coming back, who are from, you know, more conservative backgrounds, you know, there's counseling available or somebody to go, but I can't imagine that there isn't some, you know, huge block to going in for help, because I felt embarrassed, and I talk about this stuff all the time, and right. I had to, and I'd even heard stories of people, you know, I mean, there's so many people who have come out to talk about that, you know, Jonathan Winters and oh goodness, I'm so sorry, I'm going to forget everybody's name who has ever come out to talk about it.
William Styron?
William Styron, the guy who he does, was a talk show host in the 70s and 60s and 70s. Really, he interviewed John Lennon and Janis Joplin.
Dick Cavett. Oh, I didn't know that about
Cavett. He's totally come out about going into the psych ward. And
really?
Yeah. And
but he's so handsome.
And cheerful and fun, and he was on TV.
He has so much to be happy about. Is there anything more aggravating than that? Than when people say, but look at what you have to be grateful for. That you might as well just wear a sign that says, I don't understand depression.
I don't understand. Well, because, yeah, it's like, I mean, well, William Styron's book, Darkness Visible, I mean, that is it. Like, just, whoa, you know, just like it has nothing to do with anything, you know, has nothing to do with, it's like you forget anything in the past, like your brain just forgets anything in the past. Like, I could not believe that I was ever going to come back from it. And I just thought, I've got to end it. And also with our healthcare system, which, I mean, I have great insurance, but, you know, they kind of want to get you out of there. And, which, I mean, they trusted me, like they gave me, I was trying new medications and all the mood stabilizer medications have different side effects. I mean, just like any other illness, you know, I'm sure anyone who's had any experience taking medication, it's like the side effects are sometimes worse than the actual.
It's like two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah. And so I was taking something that started, cognitively affecting me, where I couldn't say things.
Is this while you were in the hospital?
No, this was while I was trying to work. You know, I was like trying to get the meds, you know, to change my meds, and then still work. And that was ridiculous.
Wow.
Yeah, because I mean, and I think nobody, that's another thing, is that nobody will tell you to stop working. Like, people go, right. Well, you seem, I mean, you're competent, you know, like, well, of course I'm competent, but like, you wouldn't say to somebody who just had a kidney transplant, you wouldn't say, you know, maybe you should fly to Atlanta this weekend, you know, do maybe like 8 shows. I mean, you can do it. I mean, this is stuff you can do, you know, because it's not, I guess, and that's what happened, is I didn't take the time off, and it really snowballed into this nightmare, you know, of... I've told this story before. I was in Chicago and was supposed to do a bunch of shows, and I just thought, okay, I just got to go, even though I was feeling worse and worse, like just like not able to think. I don't know if you have ever had that experience, but it's terrifying. Not able to think or calm down or, you know, and I have all the benefits at my disposal. You know, I exercise, I eat right, I have tons of friends and family and support, and I have a, you know, therapist and all that stuff. And
you go to support groups?
Yeah, groups, and yeah, I mean, meditation, you know, everything. And I and you know, I was in Chicago. I've lost all of my identification. Like, I was trying to get ready for the show, and I just somehow lost everything. Like, I was walking the streets, and I just lost everything. Somehow cut myself on something. I started bleeding, and I was like, and so I called my mom. I'm like, she's like, honey, get yourself to the airport. Go to Delta. Tell them you are gold medallion. And tell them about your website. And so it came to pass, Paul Gilmartin. And I got an upgrade all the way home to Los Angeles. And I missed those shows. But I think, which I felt just so ashamed about. And I had and there isn't a lot of heads up either when you're taking medication. Because they don't know what the side effects are going to be. So sometimes they don't tell you what they probably will be because they don't want you to think that you're going to have them or whatever. Anyways,
each person is a little bit different.
Yeah, it's totally different. So, but, and it did, it was such a long process. It was like a year until I've only started feeling better, more like myself, like probably the past 3 or 4 months.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, it's a long time, and that was at least I want to say that because I wanted it to be right away. Right. You know, I was just like, I'll get this taken care of, and everything's going to be great. And it's just and that's what everybody else wants too. Just like fix it, okay? Back to work. You're right. Doing great, and yeah, and I definitely wanted that too, and
I'd just like to interject at this point. The two most important things, I think, when you're dealing with a mental illness towards yourself, the two most important things are kindness and patience.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the hardest thing because your brain is all confused and you're feeling terrible about yourself. And, you just got to... I have some really good friends and who are very... yeah, loving and caring, and said, oh, come stay overnight with us or whatever. But at the same time, there's some point where I felt like I needed to be hospitalized because I didn't want to put them in the position of like, hey, could you just kind of watch me?
Right.
I don't know what I'm going to do.
When was the first time you... And we'll come back to the hospitalization, but I want to kind of set the table for where this all started and how it progressed. What was your childhood like?
It was upper middle class Duluth, Minnesota. Delightful. My father's a physician. I think I just got the gift. I don't think there was anything terrible happening. I think it just from my brain has the gift of seeing the terrible, but it wasn't spectacularly dysfunctional or anything. But I started having, when I was 10 years old, I started having suicidal ideation, like starting to think of wanting to die and kind of writing in my journal of wanting to die. And I got into like kind of obsessive prayer, like praying to God, please help me, please help me, please help me. And then I think I was like, oh, no, God doesn't exist. Anyways, he does exist for some. And
do you believe in God?
Not so much anymore. Now and partially because of that that mental crash, because I felt no comfort, like nothing, and just feeling like, okay, and feeling like some of my spiritual friends were not super helpful in that area. We're like, you just need to keep praying, and God will. And I do think it is a function of the brain, is our God consciousness, and mine was just broken and off. And I do believe in human beings. I do. I know I don't understand why people are kind or loving, and I don't. I know I'm not powerful at all. But I also, I don't like that idea of saying, I did have some friend of mine come visit me at the hospital who was of that belief where she said, oh, you know, this place just has really negative energy. God, you really need to get out of here. That's what I said, but they 5150'd me. And I'm like, you know, and they're like, they took away my shoelaces. You know, you need to do, and I'll drive you. Let's go to Ojai, right? Like, jump off, right? Or, like, go slowly into the cold water or, like, from a tree, right? You know, I just feel like this is the story you're telling yourself. I mean, I talked to my spiritual advisor. He said, if you want to leave, if you want to go to the next level, you know, maybe you're done with this plane of existence and you want to move into the next world. And, you know, I'm ready to let you go.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And I was like, you're horrible. And please come visit me tomorrow. And you're horrible. And if you could bring me some sort of bottled Diet Coke, because they won't let us have cans. And it's the one thing I'm living for, besides crushed ice. They have lots of crushed ice machines in the psych ward, which is helpful. And, hey, why don't you bring that little ray of sunshine over to the children's hospital?
You wouldn't have to make a wish if you believed.
You know, where there's that element with religious, or where it's like, it's somehow your fault that you've distanced yourself from this God through sin or through lack of awareness. And I just feel like that's so cruel, you know, to say to people. I mean, it can be a great comfort, I think, if you believe it, but then at some point, you know, it's devastating when you can't feel it at all. But I don't know. So
childhood, suicidal ideation at 10?
And so I developed sort of an eating disorder, I think, which kind of helped me kind of numb out, where I'd, you know, starve and then eat a bunch of food, you know, so I think it kind of helped me regulate my mood, really, you know, where it's like I could kind of be out of it all the time.
Was it like it gave you something to focus on other than the thought of killing yourself?
Yeah, it was kind of, because I also started having a little OCD around the same time of, there's a type of OCD, it's called like unwanted thought syndrome, which people think I'm making up, but I have. There's some books about it called The Imp of the Mind, and what's the other one?
By the way, Maria, people that take the survey on the website, you cannot believe how many people have unwanted thought syndrome.
Yeah.
I love my dog more than anything in the world, they'll write, and I think constantly about killing it.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, these people take this anonymously, so I can't email them back and say, you have no idea how common that is, that people have unwanted thoughts. And the most common one is you're at the top of a building,
yeah,
and you just keep thinking, I'm going to jump. I'm going to jump. I'm going to jump. I'm going to jump. But that, it can present itself in many, many other...
Many, and horrendous things. Okay. Like, things like, there's another book is Tormenting Thoughts and Secret Rituals, which is, and because it's about... It happens as a part of postpartum depression too, where women you'll think of molesting or killing your baby or something, and it's such a taboo thought, because every human being has weird thoughts going through their heads. Like, I mean, I don't know if you ever, sometimes comedians, you know, will say things like that, like, "Here's that, my dog looks sexy," like,
right,
you know, whatever. But for most people, it just fleetingly go through your mind and you just like blink and go, ugh, and move on. But if you have like that OCD trait, you start trying to want to get rid of the thought, which makes it come back, you know. So I started like gripping my fists, you know, started to avoid people, which that's what happens with OCD. You start avoiding the whatever it is, whatever the dirt or external thing is. But I started avoiding. My thing was, I was lightly molested as a child. It wasn't, you know, it was just a sort of like, oh gracious, I won't go into detail. But anyways, it wasn't a long term thing, and it was just, but it was very big in my mind of what had happened, and it was just some light
touching around the breasts. Anyways.
Well, you know, I say this all the time in the podcast, Maria. It's not what happens physically as much as it is the mishandling of our soul and the feeling that we don't matter, that somebody is sending us a signal, you don't matter, you are my object. That is the injury.
That's the powerful thing. And I think I was also a super sensitive kid. But anyway, so what my unwanted thoughts would be is that I would do that to another person. So I stopped spending time with friends, like, because I was worried that I would reach out and try to touch somebody. And then also I started not being able to sleep at night because I was worried I was going to kill my entire family. And then I told my mom that, you know, I finally got up the courage to tell my mom that because I wasn't sleeping. And they sent me to therapy where I went and talked to an ex-nun and she let me sleep on her couch, which is basically all that happened, which was therapeutic in itself to get to sleep. But it was also, it was Christian therapy. So she gave me this terrifying book called Hinds Feet in High Places, which is this horrendous, like, allegorical book about a, it's like a dwarf going on a journey. Anyways, I found it so deeply disturbing, and I still do now. I went and got it to read it to see what it was like, and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, why would this be a comfort at all? And it was all about suffering, and that this little being suffers and suffers and suffers, and then through suffering meets God. Whoa. You know, I mean, I was like 12, you know, like, oh, it's just so awful.
She couldn't give you, "Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret."
Yeah, want some more upbeat, you know, Clifford, the big red dog. What about that guy? He's pretty, that's pretty comforting.
So, the unwanted thoughts, you told your mom about that, and then this therapist knew about that.
Right, and my mom thought I was gay because of those thoughts. She thought it was a gay thing that I was thinking of molesting, you know, because it was girlfriends. But it was like, it wasn't like that. It wasn't like I was attracted to somebody, and I have really thought through that extensively. As Jackie Cation says, I've been to college. And you know, so it wasn't about that. You know, this is the same as, like, I didn't, you know, you don't want to molest your dog. You don't want to kill your dog. But it's like, as soon as, it's just like this dark thought that, and then you can't get it out because you want to fix it. And it, what does it mean about me as a person? And then I've got to make sure that I don't do it. So I've got to isolate myself from people. And I had that until I was about 35. And I finally decided to Google on the internet. I love the internet. And, you know, disturbing thoughts. And up came all these OCD sites, and I ordered some books, and I got an OCD therapist, and did some flooding where you, I mean, they have it on that OCD show where it's like somebody sits in a dumpster. And the equivalent of that for me was like letting myself think all the horrible things I want and staying with people, like just sitting with a friend and just going, oh, I'm having all these horrible, creepy thoughts, and just letting it peak, get as bad as possible, and then and finding out nothing happened. So so it was but yeah, so it was a big deal.
Are you comfortable sharing any of those thoughts?
Intense. They're just so
I have them too.
Yeah,
I have them too. And they don't stick with me as long as they stick with you. But they shame me.
Yeah, there's shaming.
And that's,
yeah, yeah.
And that's what I the reason I ask you to share that some is I would be willing to share some too, if you want to go back and forth to help the listener feel less fucked up.
Well, I do have the joke that I do where which brings up where I talked to the therapist, OCD therapist. She says, "Have you ever thought of?" Yeah, just all, they have to ask you questions of what your thought patterns are. And what was it? I've forgotten this joke now, but how, Have you ever not wanted to go to a religious institution because you worried you'd lose control, run up on the altar, take a shit, and yell, "I am a promise keeper"? Have you ever not wanted to go to SeaWorld because you were, if you're left alone with a baby starfish in a tide pool, you'd try to take it out and kiss its poop hole? Okay. Have you ever not wanted to spend alone time with friends or family because you'd worried you'd chop them up into chunks and bits and then have sex with the chunks and bits and then put the chunks and bits on a Caesar salad and toss it and then feed it back to your parents or eat it yourself? Yeah. And I mean, really, because we have imaginations, like, it just goes and goes and goes. And I mean, that's the tenure of what, I don't even know if that's the right word. That's the thematic of what I would think about. And I just, it does, it would be pretty good if I could talk about it, but it just does gross me out so much that it makes me feel bad.
Okay. We won't go there then, but I just wanted...
I just want to let everybody know I've thought of everything.
I feel the same way. Slicing nice people's heads off, fucking babies, yeah, killing puppies, you name it. Where the fuck did that come from?
Yeah. And I mean, there's a, and I think, you know, there is a difference between that almost everybody has weird thoughts that come into their head, and that's the only people who get obsessive about them are people who are most likely never to do them, who are like the people who are so hyped, like the person who is worried that they're filthy and they wash their hands 1,000 times a day. They're the least likely person to ever be filthy. But, and then there's a difference between that and like psychosis, where somebody might genuinely or... when somebody's a predator or something like that. I mean, there's a genuine difference between that, and I want to take that seriously too, that there is that as a problem if you act out on those things. But that's the reason I think people don't talk about it, because it's like you don't want people to misunderstand.
Right.
Because I've had that happen. I went to a therapist and a psychiatrist. I told them, I just kind of said it in passing, just saying, "Well, I have a bunch of thoughts and everything." And then they asked about it, and I was like, "I was trying to educate Paul because I just want to help." And and both of them were horrified. Were just like, "Well, I might need to make a report about this." Like, one guy said that I could be psychotic, and I was just like, "And he was it's like." I can see why people feel alone, because it's a harder thing to talk about because people can misunderstand what you mean by it. It's not a delightful thought that you're wanting to enjoy.
Right, and these aren't thoughts that, you know, I'm going to hold that thought and go masturbate. No, that's the last thing I'm thinking this thought.
Yeah. So anyways.
Okay. So you're 10, 12 years old. You've got an eating disorder.
Yeah.
You've got unwanted thoughts syndrome, and you've got suicidal ideation.
Right. And
you're a triple threat.
I'm a triple threat, and also, but I got a great family, and I got, you know, good schools going to, and I'm learning to play the violin. I was an excellent violinist from the age of 3 to, you know, and I think those things do help a lot. Like I was in a gifted kids program where you could go and, you know, had a really good neighborhood where it's like I could knock on my neighbor lady's house and go, "What are you doing?" And I could, you know, and she would go, "Well, I'm just playing the piano." And then, you know, I could have some place to hang out, like a nice neighborhood where you could, there was a community. So I look back on that and I go, "Oh my God, that's awesome that I had that." And I think the one thing I think that most people are in the U.S. can relate with is that you can so easily be isolated. Like, you put kids in front of a TV, and the kids love the TV, and you might not see them for 6 hours, and Yeah, I just, and I know, I wonder about that. Like, that's probably why I'm not a parent, is because I probably would want to put them in front of a TV, but because children are exhausting. But I think that's problematic too, because then you don't know how to connect with people or comfort yourself through connection rather than, or and having boundaries, but, you know, having healthy relationships rather than just a TV
and
or
also
video games.
I would imagine too that the little 12-year-old girl thinks that she's worse than everybody.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah.
So that is standing between you and bonding and feeling a part of, because in your mind is always the thought that I'm the biggest piece of shit in the room. If they only knew, they would all turn and run out of here. When in reality, you're probably the most sensitive, funny, loving kid in the room. But the 12-year-old, even the 22-year-old, even the 35-year-old doesn't know that.
Right. Yeah, it's... I did pretty well at stuff as a kid. You know, I was relatively... I mean, I had friends and everything, and I was relatively social, but I'm just grateful for all those little elements that I think helped a lot. Like, the, you know, the creativity helped a lot. Like, that's when... I remember I was in a gifted program. I got to do speeches. It was, like, kind of the first time, and it was probably, you know, precursor to stand-up, which I really liked performing, because... it kind of blocked out anxiety, and then also it was a way to communicate people en masse in a very safe way where they, you know, couldn't say anything back. I think my feelings got hurt so easily. Like, it was just sort of, I was such a sensitive plant that it was sort of dumb. And sometimes I wish you had videos of yourself when you're a kid, so it's like you go, oh, Jesus, like, I was a pain in the ass, like, because, you know, I think I probably was,
I can be super sweet, too, I'm sure.
You are very sweet.
Yes, sweet kid.
You had also mentioned, I listened to your appearance on the JV Club, Janet Varney's podcast,
yeah.
Loved it. You also mentioned that mental illness runs in your family.
Yes, yeah, and... I don't know. My mom's done a lot of genealogical stuff, so there's certain members of her side of the family who just like, and then she went in the attic and didn't come out for 25 years. Like, okay, that sounds familiar. You know, like, you know, back in the 1880s where it's
sure.
Like, she didn't want to be around people. And
all she wanted to do was churn butter.
Yeah. Everyone said how sweet she was, though. She was very nice when you saw her.
Yeah.
But my aunt has had manic episodes on my mom's side, and my mom has had one hypomanic episode. I think my mom, where she didn't go totally full blown, but just that sort of super agitated, calling the Pope, which. Somebody should call him.
Did she get through?
She did get to. I mean, my mom is very charming. She did get to talk to a Monsignor.
Did she really?
Yeah. I don't know if he hung up soon after, but and she called my manager a bunch of times. Poor Bruce is telling him how I was in danger and I needed to get off the internet, and which, you know, pretty true on some level. We're all in danger. And
we all need to get off
the internet.
these are
wise. Wow. These aren't manic. But I get why people don't like mental, you know, because it is frightening. It is frightening to see somebody. Like, when my mom went off the rails, I was just like, you know, kind of made fun of it. And yeah, confusing. And it feels personal. It feels like they're being mean. Like, my mom got kind of agitated mean, like, was saying, you know, kind of like heckling my sister on Facebook, and like, and which my sister then shut her out, but you know, saying, oh, come on, give me a break, you don't need, like, was just being this really oddly sassy you know, sort of version of herself, but yeah, cruel, not very nice. And And Yeah, so that it was disturbing, you know? And I wanted, and she didn't, she also didn't want to get help, you know, because I think that's part of the mania is you're like, I'm fine.
And part of it probably feels good because you're feeling great. Vigorous and energized.
And
very mentally focused.
Right, right. Totally, totally focused. And it's so funny, my mom, she used to work in the psych ward that she went into in Duluth, which.
Really?
I mean, that is so. Brutal slash courageous, like to live in a smaller town and have to go into a unit where you'll know people. She knew everybody, and you know how humbling that is. And yeah, so and that's what I felt that way. I went to a Glendale and Venice Medical Center a couple times, and then once to Las Encinas in Pasadena, and. You know what it is
you should
like.
Write a travel book about them.
Well, that's I did want to do that, like some sort
Seriously?
Of Zagat's too, because there's no. I mean, I got well. I was a little bit out of my gourd, but I went to Las Encinas and it was all false advertising. Like they said there was going to be a swimming pool and yoga, which who knows if I could have done, but none of it. Like it wasn't at all there. There's nothing. They just hadn't updated their website for 4 years or something. And I think that's the thing that's interesting about mental health. It seems like people are ashamed to be there, so they're less likely to complain on some level, like, because you look crazy anyways sure. for complaining, so.
Oh, she's going on and on about there should have been a pool.
Yeah. And you know, it is a hospital, and you are just there so that you're safe. But it was like, I guess, you know, like I was a dumb, because I tried to find some place that was aesthetically pleasant, you know, that because that helps your mental health. If there's trees. And I'd been to Las Encinas just in passing before. Sometimes they have support groups out there. And yeah, so I went out there and it was... yeah, it was
not
just,
good.
Well, it was good in that it was safe and it, but there's just funny psychiatrist story, like this the psychiatrist who okay, so he's got an iPad, an iPhone, and like another bag of tricks, and he sits down and he's like kind of lays out his entire body. He's probably like 6'3", puts his feet up on the table, and he's like, so. And kind of like squidges down in his chair, kind of like a basketball star. And I'm like, what? What's going on? I mean, not that, I mean, I get it. You're here all day. You know, maybe you see everything. You're tired. But then, then he started taking phone calls during the session, which is, I had to pay cash out of pocket. He was the only psychiatrist I could see. So it's $350. And he was taking calls. And I said, hey, man. You know, could you just not take a couple calls as well? I'm very busy. I go, yeah, you know. So I tried to say something about it, and then we got into, you know, like what he was just asking about my story. I think he was listening because he did say, when I said I was a comedian, and all of a sudden I hear from his iPad come up the sound of. Like a voice or something like that. I was like, oh, is he playing a video game now? Like, what's going on? He had YouTubed me during the session and was like playing it back to me like target spots. And I was like, hey, hey, buddy. Hey, what? And I said, you know, this is insane. And I think I was fairly pleasant about it, and he said, oh, well, I just had to make sure that you weren't psychotic. And I'm like, you know, if somebody's psychotic, you check that shit later out, you know, like, right. Like at least, so you're Jesus, you know. I think I'll put that in an internet search engine a little bit later and just see what comes up. You don't look like the Jesus I know, but wow. I'm going to just take you for your word. Like, he was saying that he... you know, had to know that I was really an entertainer. Like, how many people say that they're entertainers in Los Angeles County? Even if I'm not, who gives a shit? Like, what does that have to do with anything? So that, I think, the humbling part of it of going, Yeah, like what you were saying, when you go into the hospital, it's like you just gotta let go and go, okay, I'm here, and just let go, just hope for the best, because I'm, you know, it was good for me to be there, because I felt safe, you know, and I was, you know, so.
I just want to interject something for anybody. I'm so glad that you talked about that, because a lot of people will have an experience like that and then say that stands for all psychiatry and they will never go back.
Oh my God. Yeah. No.
There are bad ones out there, but the majority of help out there is good. And if you just keep going, just keep looking, you will find the right one, and you will know, because when you walk into that room, or after a couple of visits, you will feel safe, you will feel listened to, and you will feel like, okay, I'm moving forward with this person
now. Yeah, and this guy could have just been having a bad day.
He's a fucking asshole. Yeah,
well, burned out, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. Everybody has, I mean, I know, obviously, I've had some bad days at work where I have not shown up. And so I get that, but yeah, I've also had some wonderful ones. The one in the... I mean, have you ever read the medical reporter for, he writes, he's a physician, Atul Gawande, is it? He's Mm-mm. Sometimes he'll write.
I don't read foreigners.
Okay. he's an American, and we're all immigrants. just about the American healthcare system, and like, I just the idea that listening is so important, part of medical, like any medical transaction, is like, just that it's healing to be heard, you know,
and so healing.
Yeah. To just, and to be like the guy, this guy who was the psychiatrist in the over at Glendale Adventist, he said, "Tell me your story from the beginning," which I was like, what? Like, in a very calm, like, genuinely interested way. And I was like, oh my God, dude, you're good. Like, that's very generous. Like, that's very generous. And it just seemed, yeah, just like a very, of course, it meant I wanted to keep it tight. I tried to keep it tight. Because I don't want to, you know, go over the light, but he did have a light, and then I did try to wrap it up after the 5-minute mark. But yeah,
did he lose interest when the checks went out?
Yeah, he totally lost. But that's because he was distracted. Yeah. Wasn't that he wasn't enjoying the show?
Stand-up jargon, yeah. That Marie and I are exchanging.
but and I have a current psychiatrist who, she's not perfect. You know, we've had some, like, I got totally irritated when. She put me on, or she didn't put me on. I chose, accepted the prescription of Lamictal, which is, I think, is very successful with people who mood stabilizer. And one of the main side effects, though, is cognitive problems where you have trouble speaking, talking, or thinking. And I think if you're, you know, and I felt so mad that she did not tell me that, you know, that was one of the main side effects that one would find. I was like, dude, I'm a, you know, like, I'm a comedian, like, that's my job. And so I was able to tell her that, and she was like, yeah, I just haven't had, she hadn't had anybody who'd had that kind of job before. So,
so you got off that one.
Yeah, I got off that one. I mean, that's, I think, good, too, to be able to share, you know, I'm sure she, you know, she's been irritated with me, because one thing I do, I don't know if you do this, Paul, but I like to forget to refill my prescriptions. Oh my God! What? I'll be fine just for a couple days off. What am I doing? Don't touch the hot stove, as my sister says. The stove is hot. Don't touch it. What if I just go off my meds for a couple? No. Hey, stove, hot. Don't touch it. So that's, I cannot imagine how irritating that is to physicians. It's like, you know, because I've called her from various cities and said, oh, I forgot, can you call in a prescription and the thing, you know, and that there, I'm sure there is a huge high burnout rate, because it's just super stressful. I have friends who work in mental health, and just to have people, and especially people like myself, white, privileged, you know, I've got everything. And then, you know, to hear that person being in crisis, it's like, oh, come on. You know, when there's plenty of people, I have a friend who worked in mental health in South Central and Compton Mental Health Center, and people are sleeping overnight in the alley to make their meds appointments.
Wow.
Because you have to take 3 buses to get there, or, I mean, like, it's...
And you also think about the fact that that is a depressed person,
yeah, yeah.
who struggles to get up, who is struggling to do the most mundane of tasks.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Imagine how many people aren't willing to jump over those hurdles
yeah.
and are just going to sit in their sickness and
yeah.
take what comes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, or why not just drink all day? Because, I mean, you got to wait at the mental health clinic while you're feeling horrible for 4 hours for your appointment. Maybe they're there. Maybe the appointment got screwed up and you've got to come back tomorrow on 2 to 3 buses. Maybe they'll have your meds, you know, and yet it's not,
And a lot of the people you probably encounter at that place are burned out.
Super
and so
burned out.
You get the feeling, the nonverbal cues, that they don't really care about me.
Right. They don't care. Yeah. And my friend had 200 clients, 200, one person, 200 clients. And you know, many of those clients are people with severe mental, you know, like schizophrenia and who had a number of things going on, like drug and alcohol abuse, like just so many things. Yeah, I feel like some people have it really terribly. And I guess that was the good thing in hearing from people, especially in the hospital. I found that some of the people who are lifelong, you know, schizophrenia, where, you know, sometimes you're in and out of the hospital and halfway house and or on the street, or it feels better to be on the street and off your meds than it feels to be on the meds, because the meds make you feel fat and sleepy and terrible all the time. You know, like those people just seem to be very zen on some level. You know, like I have a joke just saying that, you know, sometimes you gotta wrap a blanket burrito around your meats and cheeses, put a little feed bag of microwave popcorn around your neck, and have the Coast Guard take you to Lost at Sea Hospital, because you are lost at sea. And there you'll walk around a cement courtyard with a schizophrenic man with no teeth and no pants who keeps saying things like, "It gets better." I don't know if I believe you, but you're very sweet. But that's like,
it was that your experience?
So sweet. Yeah, like really lovely, sweet man. Like I was just, yeah, pacing the halls like everybody. And he would always come by and go, "You're going to be okay." And, you know, and you know, he'd obviously been through this a billion times, you know, being hospitalized. And it was, yeah, it's just very... very sweet. Very.
Can we talk about the hospitalization from the beginning of before, where you were and how it progressed to the point where you knew you wanted to hospitalize yourself?
Well,
this was about a year and a half ago.
Well, yeah, like a year.
I remember
and a
getting
half.
An email from you saying that you were checking yourself in.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, didn't get a response from that. No,
I did. I did email.
No, yeah, I know. Yeah. You did. You did. Yeah. What happened? Probably ever since I turned 40, I started, and I don't know if this is a biochemical thing or I also situational thing. I moved to a house, so I was more isolated. There's also a bit more stress and pressure. I had a relationship breakup. There were a bunch of things going on, so it's like, maybe those things added to it. And I told my mom had a manic episode, and I told my friends, "Hey, if I ever start talking too fast or having a lot of great ideas, just let me know, you know, just, you know, and I'll go go into the Hooskow. And
can I stop you for one second? You have a bipolar.
Bipolar 2, I guess, is the new Gladiator sandal. And so that's what it's called now.
Okay.
But yeah, because I always thought I was just depressed, which I felt that was true. But I did have times of like agitated and wanting, getting a bunch of stuff done. I do remember staying up all night, being able to stay up all night doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's like a light mania. And I didn't realize that. Because I'd heard about bipolar 1, which is, you can really tell, you know, somebody's spending thousands of dollars and then alternately really cutting themselves, or, you know, severe ups and downs. And I didn't know that I have that. So my friend said, "Hey, Maria, you know how you told me? It just seems like you're kind of talking kind of fast." And so I was like, "Okay." And my psychiatrist said also that I, past, you know, couple months have been saying, you're speedy. You're like really speedy. I want you to try this mood stabilizer." And I was like, "No, I don't need that. That's for crazy people." And so I was refused. And then, so then I thought, okay, I'll go on this mood stabilizer. And I just wanted to do the responsible thing. And I was feeling bad. So I thought, I went to Las Encinas and it was, you know.
Got ready for a nice swim.
Right, ready for a nice swim. It's going to be a relaxing weekend. And so it wasn't super high pressure. Like, I was just like, oh, I'm going to nip this in the bud and just not be by myself while I'm going on this new medication. I'm not feeling the greatest. So I did that, and it was helpful. And I think that's when I got on Limbic Doll. And I was like, okay, well, I better have this because I've spent 3 days in the hospital. So back out on the road. And, with Limbic Doll, wasn't working. And then also starting to have real problems with working. And
because it was difficult to form sentences and thoughts.
Yeah, and I started to get more and more terrified and more sort of jacked up, depressed, like suicidal, hopeless, like. And so the second time, I went through an outpatient treatment program at the Glendale Adventist for about 6 weeks after that. And, you know, basically kind of like not breeze through it, but just was like, okay, I got this. Okay, bye. Basically, outpatient was just to create some sort of structure, I think, and that was very helpful. It was cognitive behavioral therapy, and it wasn't like, oh, I'm learning a ton. It was providing a comfort and a place to go where I could kind of stabilize while getting on these new meds. So
you were off Limbic Doll at that point?
No. I was still on it. And
okay.
But then starting to go on the road and starting to go back to work. And then just things kept getting worse. Like, I was doing the road and like I'd have to call my psychiatrist. I just freaked out, like, because I wasn't able to sleep. Yeah, it just, things started to get more and more kind of confusing and sort of frightening, and it wasn't getting better. And
that must be terrifying.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I always feel like, especially the American way is like, well, you take the correct actions, you know? I mean, and I don't know, maybe this is a, I come from a family where it's like people are always suggesting things. Well, you know what I did? my mom is like, you know what I did? It's probably exactly what I did because you raised me. We do the exact same things. We do almost the exact same things. Honey, did you call around and see if that plumber hit? Yes, I did. I did do that, Mom. Like, just like wanting to think, oh, if I take the right actions, then everything's going to be fine. And it just wasn't that way at all. It was just like this long, embarrassing process. I had a mentee, somebody who, yeah.
Were mentoring,
yeah,
in the
mentoring
support group.
And she called me, and I called her from the psych ward just to tell her I was in the psych ward, and she was like,
you know what? It just sounds like you're really busy. You know, maybe it's not. I'm like, oh no. You know what? You don't think I have what you want?
Anyways, but so the things started to just get worse and worse. And I didn't want it to become worse and worse. And I was kind of feeling like it was my fault. Like, the medications weren't kicking in, and they were kind of confusing me. Like, I just couldn't get a handle on my thoughts. And then, so I think it was 6 months later. I don't know. I'm not sure the timeline, because it's okay. Feels like it's been 5 or 6 months later. I gone through the outpatient treatment program, gotten a certificate signed by all the therapists, which does feel good. And my sister had come to visit, and I just, and I thought that that was going to help. Like, I thought, oh, it'll be fun, you know. And I just started to kind of freak out. So I checked myself in at Glendale Adventist, and which is definitely more of a very hospital-like setting. It's very closed in. There isn't, there's like a cement courtyard place to, you can hoof it around in your socks. And they give you socks. You get some nice socks with rubber.
Because they take your shoes, right?
They take your shoes and your shoelaces. You can wear your shoes as long as they're without shoelaces. Then that feels a little cuckoo.
Right.
And yeah, and you go to different groups all day that are, you know, whoa. You know, it's humbling. You know, like grooming group where you have to ask the nurse, if can I please have a, you know, razor to shave my light mustache that has grown over the, you know, and then they watch you while you're doing it. And wow, you know, it's not fun. You know, it's not super fun. But I think the important thing is I was safe, because I had started planning, like going, well, I have all these pills. I'll just, you know, and it was such a disappointment to my sister and my family, just feeling like, oh, I you know, invited her out here. Anyways, I was just feeling worse and worse and just having terrible ideas. And then, and this might have been, my psychiatrist suggested they do brain scans where they can now tell you what medications might work best for you, but you have to get off all your meds first. Mm. Oh boy. And the funny thing is, my mom does really well on Depakote, and she has for like 30 years. I didn't want to take Depakote because I worried about weight gain. So all that to say, I refused to take Depakote, which probably would have worked right away, because it's what I'm on now. And
you're on Depakote now.
Depakote now, and yeah, I feel really great. I'm still a little bit more sleepy than usual, but I went off of everything, and they did. I mean, that was just, and that's when I went to the hospital for about 7 days, because it was just.
Was that when you sent the email?
I don't know. I can't remember when I sent the email. There's several cries for help. I'm so sorry. I hope I didn't.
No, I didn't. And I feel bad, because I didn't know it was cry for help. I thought it was your way of saying, I'm going off by myself now. Please don't contact me.
Oh, okay. That's so funny. Yeah.
If I had known that you were, that you wanted visitors, because I heard you say on Janet's podcast that you wanted people to visit you, and I felt terrible, because like, oh, I would have visited
in
a heartbeat.
No, I know, and I think I think it was low self-esteem of going, oh, I don't want, and also not wanting anybody to see me like that.
It felt like you were pushing
everybody
away, just the way it was worded and everything was.
No, I think you're right, because then
I think you had said something about I'll contact you when I get out.
Yeah. And now I look back and I go, I mean, were something like that to happen again, I'd be like, oh my God, get everybody, you know, anybody want to come visit? Come visit. Because it's number one, it's hilarious. It is kind of fun. It's a very fun memory in retrospect that I share with some friends of them coming to visit. Just how ridiculous it was. And but yeah, so then I went in for about 7 days, and that was just, and it was awful. You know, I just felt awful, so awful.
Can you describe what you were feeling?
There's not really, it's not anything I'd felt before, sort of this whole gradual slide. It was like that Darkness Visible book, like just like, yeah, it's like breathing is not good. Like, I just want to be knocked out. Like, every day was just like a minute by second by second sort of torture. I've been depressed before and crying and stuff like that, and this was not crying. Like, this was just like, I am in this high state of agitation, just like sort of like I couldn't read, I couldn't write, I couldn't focus on anything. I couldn't really talk to people very well. It was very odd and disturbing. And
it sounds exhausting.
Yeah. It was, and there's no, that's the thing, they don't have any exercise. I mean, some of the things that are so helpful for mental health, they don't have. Like, there's a lot of carbs in mental health facilities and a lot of, and I think there may be some lack of funding issue or burnout, you know, like some things I thought, like, they'd have groups and there's some wonderful people, like really wonderful, who did things where people would kind of connect people. And like one lady was so great. She came in and she was Filipino and she was like, let's do a game or something. And it was hilarious. Like, it was, I mean, and it was kind of really did occupy your brain a little bit and everybody could participate. But then, like, I remember this one guy, he'd do a group every day. And the whole group would be like, let's go around the room. How's everybody feeling? And people are feeling horrible. I mean, their answers aren't going to change from day to day. Like, it's like, you know, sometimes life, you know, it's just suffering, you know? You just feel, you know, it's not good, you know? And you think, is it going to get better? And it doesn't. Anyways, how you doing, Alice? How you doing?
Well, there's a television in my head, and sometimes I hear it. I'm trying to turn it off.
Well, how are you feeling, though, Alice?
Well, I'm worried that the Russian militia is coming over the hill.
I know that, but Alice, how are you feeling?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good.
Like, so... totally useless on some level. You know, I was like, you know what would be more useful is we played a game like One Big Blob. Have you ever played One Big Blob?
No.
It's a tag game where one person has to chase somebody else, and then they start chanting One Big Blob, and then the people chase somebody else, and then they all start linking hands, and pretty soon there's like, you know, 20 people, One Big Blob, chasing one person, and then you become One Big Blob. Anyways, like easy things are having like a joke book. Like, even if people could read aloud from it, like some of the moments of relief were like, I'd ask people, you know, hey, do you have any jokes? And they tell, and I'd be like, okay, you know, it was like sort of a relief for a second because I couldn't read anything, and just to get your mind off, how it wasn't so good.
Would you try to make other people laugh and break the ice?
Oh, no. Beyond that. Yeah.
No. Sentences were too hard.
Yeah, it was not good. Not good.
So what was the turn? Any other highlights or lowlights from that?
I did see another comedian there, though.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's hilarious.
They were having some sort of issue, I think, and I think it was addiction-related. But anyways, it was so funny. They were making phone calls off the phone to get gigs the next weekend from the psych ward. And I'm like, wow. Oh my God, that is awesome.
Wow.
It was so great. Which I, you know, had I been, I mean, that's basically what I was trying to do before. Just like, and then, oh, and then I went through the outpatient treatment program again, a second time at Glendale Adventist, and that really helped me just get more into acceptance, like what you're saying, letting go, like, okay, this is it. I'm not going to make it go away and just, you know, let it ride. Like I can't fix it. And it seemed like everybody who I talked to, who had got, you know, I did talk to Jonathan Winters on the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he, I mean, it sounds like, he's had to go into the hospital a number of times. And back in the '60s, you had to go in for months. Like they would just keep you down with Valium. And then maybe you came out of whatever episode you're in. But he was very kind, you know, he said, "Hey, you got a good shrink?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Well, then you just keep going," That's it. You just keep going. And I did have friends who had been through terrible things who said it will get better. And I did not believe them at all. I did not. Which is so odd to me because I've had a very good life. So it is weird how quickly I completely obliterated that from my brain.
That's how convincing mental illness is. It's so fucking convincing. I always say, you know, George Lucas has nothing on mental illness. It creates a world that is not real, that is so fucking believable. And you really believe that it is never going to get better because the way you feel feels like it's going to last forever.
Right. Yeah, everything points towards it making sense and... It just, yeah, you're just, it's just not, yeah, it's almost, yeah, it's like it's working against you. Your brain is working against you. And, but the great thing is now, I mean, just like the wonderful thing is how much I appreciate, like, I've just, you know, I appreciate life. I'm like, oh, things are good. Oh my God. You know, like I can perform and I can think of things. Like I had this great weekend in Toronto recently where I wrote a bunch of new jokes and it was just so, so delightful. Like how grateful I am for that, that's a possibility it's just like what everybody says, you know, when they go through something and then they come out and they're like, I just have a lot of gratitude. But
it sounds cheesy and corny, but it's true.
It's totally, yeah.
I believe that life is you're either appreciating something or you're in the process of building your appreciation for something. That's how I try to look at it. Because I've lived for 40 years with a pessimistic, negative attitude, and it only buried me deeper.
Right.
Into shame and self-pity and closer to suicide.
Right. Well, and that's, I mean, I think there's something about getting older too, I think, has been like a psychological change of going, okay, especially in our society, like I may not be at the top of my game anymore. You know, maybe I'm not the best and I mean, not that I ever was the best, but maybe I'm just okay at my job. Maybe I'm just okay at my relationships. And there isn't some, like, I'm not going to wait for some magical time. And then I'm still okay. Like I saw the special. And, you know, part of me is like, oh, is it any good? And it's like, so what? Like, who cares? Like, it just doesn't matter. But if you'd like to buy it for $4.99, that is my sales pitch. So what? But you know when people ask you, how did you do comedy? Which, because I used to ask that of comedians, like, how did you make it? And it's like, I remember Emo Phillips just said, pretty soon, you've done it for a long time, and a lot of people have seen you. Okay. And that's exactly what I say that to comedians. I say, oh, yeah, you just do it, and then you keep doing it, and then pretty soon you've been doing it for a long time. People say, oh, you still doing that? And, like, there's no mystery. And I realize that's what people have been trying to tell me about relationships. Like, I thought there's this magical thing. And it's like, no, it's hard. There's going to be those 2 weeks in Laughlin where you're questioning what you do and there's blood on the wall and you have to, the only joy you get is a toaster pastry from the hallway. But, you know, and but you hang in there, you know. People say, oh, well, I mean, you have to go on these dates, which are not unlike open mics. You have to go on open mics. You just sit there for 6 hours, and sometimes you don't get up. Yeah, that's it. That's the whole thing. Like, you know, like, why have I been having such a high standard for relationships that they'll, I mean, of course, there's going to be moments of joy, you know, when you get that good gig at Flappers in Claremont, and, you know, you sell some merch, and then hopefully it's just inertia that keeps you in, and you're on that cruise when you've been married 50 years and people are like, how'd you guys do it? And that's what I feel like when I'm doing a show right now. Happy anniversary, show business. I still love you.
Is it fair to say that sometimes you just need to stop worrying and anticipating when is the great moment going to come?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just try to enjoy the moment that you're in?
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, it's like all these things that have been said through the end of time, you know, the ages. But that they said that because they are helpful and true. But I have to say that when I was feeling bad, nothing helped me. Like, yeah, like any sort of spirituality, meditation, 12 steps, like, I was
when it comes
out
to a chemical imbalance in the brain, there is sometimes nothing but medicine.
Yeah, I was just out. So, and it was comforting. Friends did come to visit me, or I talked to them on the phone, but it was, and that was great. But it wasn't any sort of, yeah, it was just bad.
Yeah.
Which I've heard that about, like, what a cancer, whatever. It's like, oh no, it was horrible. And they removed, you know, certain part, like a surgery, you know, it's just, it's horrible sometimes. And then you just keep going through it.
You just keep going through it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
You know when you love someone so much, Paul, but you can't, you know it's not enough. I painted this dog bank for my dad at Color Me Mine. It's right in front of me right now.
It's a ceramic dog.
Ceramic dog, which is also a bank because I want him to have his own money.
Where's the money going?
Money's going into the head.
Oh, you didn't choose the butthole.
Oh, well, they didn't. There wasn't a choice there at Color Me Mine.
Oh, I see. You didn't make it. You just painted it.
Oh, no. I just painted it. It's a lazy man's craft store. Okay. You just pick it out, and then they slab it with. And I worked very hard on the collar, but then I started to lose interest, and I just dabbed paint all over it. And I felt like, is that all I can do for my father? I love him so much. You know, it's like I don't know. I was just thinking about that, you know, that I can't love people enough. Like, I'm always going to let somebody down. You know, I'm going to give somebody a shoulder-based hug. I'm going to forget their birthday. I'm going to half-ass it on the last part of the paint job on their ceramic dog. How can I, you know, just let people know how I really feel? So I have a bonfire on my front lawn, and it's going 24/7, and I just tend to that. And there's a live webcam, and that way, if anyone questions, you know, if I forget something or if I'm grumpy, click on that link and you know how I feel about you, eternal flame. Anyways, that's a new joke premise, but I am going to send this to my dad.
I think it's beautiful.
Well, it's very unattractive, and I think that's also going to be great for my dad because he likes to irritate my mom and have things that are kind of unattractive out. And I can't wait to hear, you know, her saying, well, why don't we put this downstairs? You know, I think this would be great behind the TV. it is a ceramic dog bank with the tags reading JoJo. My dad's name is Joel. And anyways, it's going home for Christmas. Don't tell him what's coming.
I won't. Yeah. Well, Maria Bamford, thank you so much. I got a lot out of this.
Yes, okay. And
Seriously.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah. Good. Oh, good.
I mean,
oh.
I love talking to you. It's you're a kindred spirit, and I love what you do on and off stage. And
I just want to
thank you.
I love talking about mental illness. I never get enough. It's good. So fun.
Well, then you just opened yourself up to coming back on the podcast.
Okay, wait a minute. Okay, thanks, Paul.
Many thanks to Maria for being such a great guest and just being such a nice person. Definitely go check out her special. We'll put a link on our website. But you can find it at chill.com, and it's well worth the $5. It's a great, great comedy special. Before I take it out with a couple of surveys, I want to remind you there's a couple of different ways that you can support the show. You can support it financially by going to the website, metalpod.com. That's also the Twitter name you can follow me at. You can go to MetalPod and make a one-time PayPal donation or a recurring monthly PayPal donation, which is my favorite because then that gives me a kind of a picture of how close I'm getting to being able to support myself full-time doing this thing. I'm going to read you an email that a listener wrote about. I'll just read it. Dear Paul, a suggestion. The whole asking for monthly donations, giving away cutting boards, etc. You know what I'm talking about. You get uncomfortable and creepy when you bring it up. You speak about the ego, Eckhart Tolle, the soul. It seems to me that your ego takes over that part of the show. Your ego takes the microphone and does its dirty work, making you feel crappy, less than, not worthy, and all that yummy stuff it's so good at. Remember, the ego hates when we are the same. Not better, not worse than anyone else. I wonder what would happen if you let your soul, higher self, divine twinkle, whatever you want to call it, take over at that point. My guess is that it would not be all about you or how uncomfortable you are feeling about asking for something. My guess is that your soul would ask from a place of service and gratitude, not making the monthly donation request or cutting board raffle about you, but rather as a means to your vision, making mental health more accessible and the norm. Thank you for putting into words what I could not put into words and making me feel more comfortable about that. So donate, cocksuckers. I think I might have tainted it with that last piece. I have a stack of surveys, and I am not really sure which ones to read, so I'm just going to shuffle and read the first one that comes out on top. All right. This is from, I love it already. This is from the Shame and Secret survey, and it was filled out by a guy who calls himself Captain Bipolar. You definitely don't want to reserve a berth on that ship. He is in his 20s. He's straight, was raised in an environment that was a little bit dysfunctional. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? He says some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts as sexual abuse. May have been touched inappropriately at daycare around age 4, but I don't fully recall the incident. Deepest, darkest thoughts. I'm so sexually frustrated that I fantasized about raping a girl I truly care for and would do anything to protect. The sick irony here is not lost on me, and the very fact I allowed myself to enjoy this thought bothers me. I've also spent time seriously thinking about torturing a man that committed arson and nearly killed me and several other innocent people. I'll spare you the details, but I had planned a rather long and drawn-out affair that potentially could have allowed me to make him suffer for weeks on end. You know, an interesting thing about the fantasy that is bothering you, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but there is a book out there about the erotic mind. It's called The Erotic Mind and then colon something else. And the gist of the book is basically that the mind will create barriers to it will make us turned on by things that we are ambiguous about or not comfortable with because by its very nature, according to this book, that's what gives it the charge. And after reading thousands of these Shame and Secret surveys, there's almost nobody whose fantasies I've read about. Let's put it this way. The number of people who don't have some type of shame about something that turns them on are in the very, very slim minority. So if you have a sexual turn on that is remains in your head that isn't hurting anybody, cut yourself some slack. Deepest, darkest secrets, he writes, in a drunken stupor, I hit a person driving my car. Luckily, the incident was at a very low speed, and they got up and ran away scared, but I quickly realized how clouded my judgment had become. I love that it's a hit-and-run accident, and the pedestrian flees the scene. And, let's see. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you? He says, honestly, basic sex. I've been so ignored by women that my desires are very pedestrian. A young, sexually aggressive woman just wants to fuck me is all I... That just wants to fuck me is all that I really desire. So he also has that, obviously, in addition to the fantasies that he doesn't feel comfortable about. Would you ever consider telling a partner or close friend your fantasies? He writes, my wants are certainly pretty basic, so that in itself would not be difficult to talk about. The difficult thing to discuss is my gross lack of experience and the fact that I'm incredibly stunted sexually because of my inability to connect with other people due to my emotional disorders. You know what's funny? I read enough of these from men and enough of these from women that just make me begin to think, why don't these people start pairing up? They know what the other person feels like, what they experience. I mean, I know it sounds like I'm making some type of a joke, but I'm not. You know, maybe some type of dating site for people that have mental or emotional struggles. Right now I'm seeing a lawyer's face just shaking his head going, really? Why don't you just give me your house? Why not just give him your house? Would you ever tell, do these secrets and thoughts generate any particular feelings towards yourself? He writes, I feel like a failure as a man. I'm ashamed of myself. I'm frustrated that I do not have the emotional capability to interact well enough with women to be able to have a relationship. I'm also frustrated that I lack the ability to read body language and social cues to the same effect. You know, the fact that you are aware that you are having trouble reading body language and social cues tells me there's hope. The person that doesn't even know that there is such a thing as body language and social cues, that's the person with the problem. Here's my 2 cents. Spend it freely. This next survey is also from the Shame and Secret survey, filled out by a woman named Kendall, who's in her 20s, bisexual, was raised in an environment that is pretty dysfunctional. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? She writes, some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. When I was younger, a family member who was a few years older than me would regularly engage me in oral sex. I was young enough at the time to have no idea what sex was before she told me. Deepest, darkest thoughts. Sometimes I resent my parents for the way I've turned out, despite knowing it's not their fault. Deepest, darkest secrets. I've been cutting myself since I was 11. When I'm depressed, I will intentionally eat foods I'm intolerant to and spend the next week in bed hating myself for it. The only reason I want to find employment is to make everyone happy. If I could spend the rest of my life in bed guilt-free, I would. Whenever it's brought up that it's time I look for a job, I find it really difficult to not kill myself. Well, I certainly relate to that part about wanting to spend the rest of my life in bed guilt-free when my depression is kicking my ass. I often have a fantasy about my bed having wheels and just being able to take it wherever I have to go so I can continue laying down and doing whatever errands I have to. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. She writes, being with someone who I shouldn't be with. When I was younger, it was teachers, people too old for me, etc. Now it's doctors, psychs, my brother's friends. The older I get, the less interested I am in becoming sexual with people. And I think it's because the older I get, the less it matters how old I am / who I am. Still, if it's in some way unethical, you can count on me wanting to fuck you. If you're an adult, that is. I want to have the power over someone for them to know it's wrong, but to go there anyway. That's interesting. Would you ever consider telling a partner, close friend? She says, sure. Do these secrets and thoughts generate any particular feelings towards yourself? She writes, mostly that the older I get, the less desirable I am. The only time I've really felt desirable was when I knew I was still jailbait. Very interesting survey. I am endlessly fascinated with the things that I'm going to shuffle these again and find our last one that we're going to go out on. You know what? Let's go on a happy moments. All right. This is from our happy moments survey. And, I almost forgot to tell you. There is a new survey up. I want you guys to pick your top 10 favorite episodes of this podcast from 2012. So that survey was just posted right near the other surveys on the website. As I said, this is from the Happy Moments survey. It's filled out by Katie, who's in her 20s. And she writes, when I was in third grade, my dad showed up to pick me up from school in the middle of the school day. It was a complete surprise to me, and I was filled with excitement. He showed up in his old gray Jeep, and the loudness of it ordinarily embarrassed me. He told me that there was a swell at the beach. The waves were to be huge. We drove to the beach and watched the waves. We found a baby seal stranded on the side of a huge rock and called Animal Rescue. I felt so much love. I love that. I never get tired of reading about parents being present in their kids' lives and hearing the kid feel heard and felt and considered. That's a beautiful one. So I'm going to end on that one. I want to thank you guys for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the new intro montage. I agonized a little bit because I was like, it's longer than the other one, but I had such trouble trying to pick clips to edit out because I wanted all of those in there because I feel like they all speak of what this show is about. That was a weird note to end on. I hope you guys are having a good 2013 so far, and if you're feeling stuck, know that you're not alone. And if you've listened this far, if you're this deep into the podcast, you should definitely know that you're not alone. So, thanks for listening.